Today we're talking about the Confessions of Augustine of Hippo, a work that was written around 400 AD, regarded as one of the classic works of Western literature, and also one of the earliest works of biography. It begins with Augustine as a boy, and it shows his movement from a boy raised by a Christian mother and a pagan father, although his father is on the way to becoming a Christian. He's a catechumen through most of Augustine's childhood. It shows the movement from boyhood through the struggles of adolescence and eventually a great intellectual struggle that Augustine undergoes prior to becoming a Christian, an Orthodox Christian, one who had been a Manichae. And it's a work really that looks at some major perennial themes: the nature of evil, the origin of evil, the nature of God, and what it is to be human. I'm joined by Laurel Moffat and Matthew Tan, and I want to begin by looking at a passage in Book 6 of the Confessions where we see some of this struggle that I mentioned. But in this case, it's a struggle not in Augustine himself, but in his friend Alypius. This takes place at an event where gladiators are fighting. And Alypius, who has basically resolved that he's not going to indulge his love of these blood sports anymore, nonetheless succumbs to peer pressure, goes along to the event and says, nonetheless, I can basically get through this. Until by the end of the passage, we see that in fact he's succumbed to the bloodlust that he had resisted at the start. So I'll just read that. Alypius did not indeed abandon the earthly career of whose prizes his parents had sung to him. He had arrived in Rome before I did to study law. There he had been seized by an incredible obsession for gladiatorial spectacles and to an unbelievable degree. He held such spectacles in aversion and detestation, but some of his friends and fellow pupils on their way back from a dinner happened to meet him in the street, and despite his energetic refusal and resistance, used friendly violence to take him into the amphitheatre during the days of the cruel and murderous games. He said, "If you drag my body to that place and sit me down there, do not imagine you can turn my mind and my eyes to those spectacles. I shall be as one not there, and so I shall overcome both you and the games." They heard him, but nonetheless took him with them, wanting perhaps to discover whether he could actually carry it off. When they arrived and had found seats where they could, the entire place seethed with the most monstrous delight in the cruelty. He kept his eyes shut and forbade his mind to think about such fearful evils. Would that he had blocked his ears as well. A man fell in combat. A great roar from the entire crowd struck him with such vehemence that he was overcome by curiosity. Supposing himself strong enough to despise whatever he saw and to conquer it, he opened his eyes. He was struck in the soul by a wound graver than the gladiator in his body, whose fall had caused the roar. The shouting entered by his ears and forced open his eyes. Thereby it was the means of wounding and striking to the ground a mind still more bold and strong, and the weaker for the reason that he presumed on himself when he ought to have relied on you, God. As soon as he saw the blood, he at once drank in savagery and did not turn away. His eyes were riveted. He imbibed madness. Without any awareness of what was happening to him, he found delight in the murderous contest and was inebriated by bloodthirsty pleasure. He was not now the person who had come in, but just one of the crowd which he had joined and a true member of the group which had brought him. Reading that, I'm just struck by that quick transformation in the character of Alypius, and how, in a sense, this represents, in many respects, sometimes in reverse, what happens to Augustine through the work. So let's explore that. Why is it that Alypius feels he can, notwithstanding he doesn't want to, that he'll go along, he'll keep his eyes closed and he'll be able to resist, and by the end he hasn't?
There's that line, at least mine is a bit different from yours, but I shall prove myself stronger than you or the games.
Yeah.
I don't know what was beneath those words as far as his motivation, but that idea that I can prove myself to you, and I can prove myself, like I can enter this arena.
Yeah.
And I'll show you. Which could be proud, could be self-reliance, I don't know, but... Yeah.
Well, Augustine says that, doesn't he? Because he's addressing this work, in many respects, to God as well as to the reader. It reads very much like a prayer.
Yes.
And in that, in our translation, he says at that moment, he relied on himself instead of relying on you, as he should have done. But I think what we see here is also, there's the conflict within Alypius, which is very much like the conflict within Augustine. But there's also that conflict between two worldviews, between and two views of a society. And, one is this is still a pagan practice. We have sport, we send men into battle until they kill each other. Mm-hmm. And we sit around and we eat and drink and watch it. And then this other, suddenly this invasion of this other world view, which is saying this is wrong. This is wrong. And people like Alypius and Augustine and others are starting to sort of have a different outlook, where something which had been accepted is now seen as beyond acceptable. It cannot be accepted. It's morally bankrupt to take pleasure in watching men kill each other.
And if I could sort of jump in and talk about the clash, not just in worldviews, but also the clash in two different types of persons.
Yes.
Right? You have Alypius saying, I am going to be mentally strong against everything that I hear and see. And then he gets caught up in everything that he hears and sees.
Yes.
And I think what I see in this episode is sort of an extension of an anthropology that Augustine kind of hints at much earlier in the first chapter, where he talks about the heart being restless until it rests in God.
The first paragraph.
The very first paragraph.
Such a famous, wonderful line. Isn't
exactly.
It?
And the way I read this is that every paragraph that comes after that is sort of an extension or a demonstration of that. That we are, primarily desiring beings before we are rational.
Yes.
Simultaneously that we are rational and desiring, and you can't sort of cut one off and expect the other to retain its integrity.
Yeah.
But also the role of the senses, I think, is so fascinating.
Oh yes.
Alypius thinks, oh, I'll shut my eyes.
Yeah.
But yet what he hears infects his heart
and opens his eyes.
And
these keys turning in his ears and the eyes open.
Which it's a reminder. I think Augustine's reminding the reader, without even saying it overtly, watch out what you hear. Watch out what you see. Put things before you that will lead you in a different direction. And what I was so struck, it's in the same book, but I was so struck when I got to this section about this, the show, that Alypius, he's wounded in the heart from it, which we know before the description of it, that turns into this obsession that he can't actually quench.
Yeah.
But before that, the description of Ambrose reading, which I thought was so fascinating, because he did the description of a man reading silently, which I guess I take means that people read in a different way in the 4th century.
Yeah.
But the fact that he could put something before his eyes, which he would then be reading within his mind, that would kind of fill his senses in a way.
Yeah.
I thought that's a total contrast as far as what a human is doing.
It? Yeah. And I mean, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. There's a sort of a connection between the senses and the interior movements of the human person, of the human heart.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of another text in Book 3, where Augustine talks about the theatrical shows rather than the gladiatorial combat. There's a line in in book three, where it says, they were full of representations of my own miseries and fueled my fire.
Yeah.
So what you're seeing out there is sort of not something that is alien to you,
yeah.
but is actually an outward representation of what is actually going on
yeah.
in your own heart.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I thought that was just like a really powerful thought or idea that showed itself.
Actually, it's interesting. I mean, we've talked about the gladiators and the theatre. Mm. The other thing that he comes back to is the effect on his soul, on his spirit, his mind and body of different works of literature.
Mm.
So the famous example, when he's talking about book four of Virgil's Aeneas, the episode of the love affair between Dido and Aeneas, and how, you know, he's sort of looking back at this and he's almost appalled that he was so transfixed and obsessed by this. Mm-hmm. And then later, so clearly he has this ambivalent relationship, even when he's writing, you know, these things that he did love and that he almost is scared about these things that he loved and the power they had over him. Another example where he's talking about pagan literature, but this time in a positive sense, is Cicero.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about the ordered philosophy of Cicero and how it opened his heart to God, you know, reading this philosopher who basically says you should prefer truth over everything else, you know, all other passions, all other preoccupations. And Cicero is saying you have to, the philosopher is someone who prefers, you know, of course, as the word suggests, loves truth. And this is a fascinating thing to me as well about that interaction between the Christian world, the pagan world, that it's not like there's an absolute demarcation, you know, that he sorts through his reading of these classical authors and finds what actually is consistent with and what's inconsistent with his Christian worldview.
Yeah, it's a pursuit that is long, isn't it? And he continues to strive to find the truth.
Yeah.
But yet he also has that moment, I don't remember where he said, would that I have knocked on your door, Lord?
Yeah.
And then he kept pushing, kept pursuing truth.
Yeah.
But yet it seems that there's a simultaneous aversion to having it located in God. I don't know if that's what you found as well.
Yeah, what I sense from that is that on top of the fact that it's long, it's also messy.
Yeah.
He goes all over the place.
Yeah.
And it's not as if that he goes all over the place in such a way that, yes, he expresses regret, but he doesn't treat them like they were wasted.
Yes.
You know, at one there was one point where, I cannot remember which book, where it says, you know, these created things are platforms on which I raise my soul to you.
Yeah.
And so whilst they didn't happen and they were, you know, seemingly unfortunate events, nonetheless, they were still, you know, at work in raising Augustine's consciousness to what is true.
Yeah.
Even in something like his relationship with his mistress.
Yeah.
Even there, he was still able to find things that were good, true, and beautiful.
Yeah.
In that relationship.
Yeah.
And it's also really helpful for the reader. I mean, because every detour that Augustine takes, we take with him. And he shows us his thinking at every point, which I find incredible because it's a biography.
Yeah.
But it's also this, it's not just a biography of this person, but it's his mind, the working of his mind at every point, which is extraordinary to read of someone's thought processes at every stage. So we're taking in that thinking with him.
Yeah.
So we think those thoughts because we're reading those thoughts and then constantly having the pre-conversion Augustine with the post-conversion Augustine with the scripture.
Yeah.
It's so beautifully layered at every moment, it seems.
Mm. Then added to that, there's yourself, the reader.
Yes.
Superimposed onto it.
Yeah.
And you can kind of relate to this. This is something, this is a book that you can relate to.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, in contrast to people who have these sort of flawless characters or have this straightforward path towards either success, happiness, whatever. Here's Augustine in his messiness, and you can actually relate to that messiness.
Yeah, it's consoling in that.
Yeah. It is consoling.
He's so real. Yeah. I was at a party on Saturday night and I was talking to a friend about the confessions. And we were looking around this crowded room of people and we're like, he could be right here.
Yeah.
Like his the things that he's talking about that humans think and feel and do, it's as current now as it was then.
Yeah.
It's just extraordinary.
Let's talk a little bit about the role of the created order of creatures. We've talked about you know, the role of the senses. We've talked about how, you know, the passage that you referred to where he sees the created order as basically serving as a series of stepping stones to the uncreated. And yet at the same time, they can be stepping stones or stumbling blocks. The same thing can either be a path to God, in Augustine's reckoning, or basically a hindrance to an encounter with God.
Yes.
And the mistress is an example, you know, of that in his account. The thing I have in mind is this famous episode when he's a boy about the pear, in the pear, you know, the garden with the pear trees. And let's talk about that. What is it that attracts him about this idea of stealing a pear? Why does he want to do it?
That's so fascinating, isn't it? Because it's not, it's like the pear or the tree does not attract him as much as the wall that he has to get over to steal the pears.
So it's the fact that it's forbidden.
Yes, the
the
don't cross this line yet.
Because I think he even says, I wasn't even hungry.
Right.
I didn't sort of do it because I was hungry. That might excuse that sort of behaviour. But I did it because I wanted to do something that was forbidden to me.
Yeah. I mean, there was a line where he says elsewhere where that sin is a curving in on oneself.
Yeah.
And I thought that was actually a good demonstration of that, simply because when you curve in on oneself, you actually aren't even... The irony is that you're not even focused on the created order anymore.
Yeah.
It's actually just yourself.
Yes.
And you want the, in the case of the episode with the pears, it was sort of an episode where he can indulge in his love of having transgressed the order of things. So much so that it doesn't really matter whether it's about the pear or not. It's actually some reference to myself at the end.
Yeah. Well, that's a great point on which to finish. Thank you both for the discussion.